Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.allowedla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2005.
I have the privilege of introducing tonight's very special guest interviewer, Marianne Wiggins, who will do the honors of introducing Jane Smiley. Marianne Wiggins is the author of 7 books of fiction, including John Dollar, Almost Heaven, and Eveless Eden, which was nominated for the Orange Prize. She has won the Whiting Writers Award, an NEA grant, and the Janet Heidinger Kafka Prize. She won the Commonwealth Club of California Book Award and was a National Book Award and Pulitzer Prize finalist for Evidence of Things Unseen. Please welcome Marianne Wiggins.
Thank you. Thank you. I ask you to bear with me a slight disfigurement. I caught a frisbee in the face over the weekend playing with my daughter's dog. That aside, in anticipation of this evening's guest, I pulled my old used copy of 1,000 Acres off the shelf. And I have a unique experience with all my books. I lived in England for 16 years and moved to California, so my books came through the Panama Canal. So when I take an old, previously read book down, not only does its travel come pouring out of the pages, but also that great sense of where I was when I read this book. And as I took it down and I opened it up, aside from the Panama Canal Association, there was this immediate memory of the weekend that I spent reading this fabulous book. And I hadn't read Jane Smiley before this. 1,000 Acres was my introduction to her writing. And it was one of those wonderful, gray, rainy, drizzly London weekends, which is why I think there are such great readers and writers in England, because the weather is so conducive to staying in bed. And I literally stayed in bed, and from the first 10 pages, I thought, be Jesus, this woman has a confidence that is incomparable. She just believes in what she's doing, and she's bringing it forth with great spirit and incredible craftsmanship. And I was knocked sideways. And it was the same confidence that we first encountered in 1,000 Acres that carried her subsequent books, Moo and Horse Heaven, to the top of the bestseller lists. She knows what she's doing. She can experiment with voice. We have confidence in her, and it's always great fun to be in her company. However, 4 years ago, in September of 2001, Jane was in the middle of the book that she was working at the time, In Good Faith. And there's no other way to describe what she came into other than an absolute solid wall of lack of confidence. It was the beginning of September. She had about 200 pages written. She had every reason to look forward to September's because, as she notes in the beginning of 13 Ways of Looking at a Novel, September is her birthday month. And she makes a sort of lovely big deal about that being the best month to be born if you're going to be a writer. And so she was looking forward to that September, and then September 11th happened. Jane not only experienced a lack of confidence in her own work, but she experienced the mutual devastation that we all felt. In a writer of less spirit, she may have stayed quiet for a long period of time, but what she did, and it may have been the equestrian in her, she got back on her horse and determined that she was going to work her way into hope and into writing again, and the way that she was going to do it was by reading 100 novels. Now, it's one thing to watch paint dry, but it's quite another to watch Jackson Pollock paint. And watching Jane Smiley read through 100 novels and tell us of her experience and how she found hope in that is just exuberant. It's absolutely marvelous. I think this book deserves to be a classic of its kind. It is written for everyone who loves to read, especially novels, but it's also written for the hopeful writer in all of us. So I want to start talking about this with her. Please help me welcome my fellow reader, my fellow writer, our fellow Californian, our Lady of the Pulitzer, whose name itself is an apt narrative description, Jane Smiley.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad you didn't tell me that earlier.
That which part?
The intimidating introduction.
But it was all true, wasn't it? So 45,000 pages in 3 years. Dude, I'm so jealous. I think everybody here would be.
Well, it was a wonderful thing to do to sort of lie back on the bed and open the novel I was reading and say, "Oh, I guess I'll go to work now." I really enjoyed it, and then I would get into some kind of relationship with the novel, and then within about a day or so after I'd finished it, I would sit down and write about it. And that part was fun too. I was just wrestling with sometimes positive feelings, sometimes negative feelings, but sort of trying to encapsulate my current experience or the experience I have with the novel before going on to the next one.
What Jane did, and she makes a point in the book, is to say that these are not the greatest, 100 greatest novels, that any random 100 novels you could probably determine as being the greatest novels. These were novels that you needed to read for one reason or another. And she starts with the oldest. It's right down here, The Book of Genji. Mm-hmm. The Tale of Genji. Genji. Is it a hard G?
It is, I'm sorry to say.
How did you know that?
Someone told me.
So, well, thanks for passing it on. It's now up to you to spread the word. 1,000 years old. Mm-hmm. Something like how many pages?
It's about 1,000 pages, 1,020. It depends on the translation. The three current translations are widely different from one another. I read the Seidensticker translation, which I believe is not the one they have in the library.
So was it purely chronology that made you start there? You just thought, I'm going to read the oldest tale.
Well, yes, but it was because I wanted to get the farthest away from where we were in September 2001. So I figured I would read the oldest novel I could to get the farthest away from modern life. But in fact, chapter 2, Genji and his friends are sitting around talking about whether it's better to marry a beautiful woman or a useful woman. I thought, where have I heard this before? You know, they weren't that far away. But the other wonderful thing about the tale of, well, there are many, but one of the other wonderful things is that its preoccupation is with the ephemerality of life. And so there's a lot of poems, there's a lot of depictions of festivals, of autumn scenes, spring scenes, whatever. And it was a wonderful thing to think about at the time of the World Trade Center attacks, is the ephemerality of life. And yet, at the same time, here I was, 1,000 years on, in a room and being a person and speaking a language that Lady Murasaki could not have imagined. And I was still reading this book. And so that sort of gave me a kind of vertigo, I have to say. But it was a pleasurable vertigo.
And you moved right from that into Vinland Tales? What was it, the next
one? No, the next one was a couple of Icelandic sagas, which I had studied in graduate school, Laxdæla Saga and Egil Saga. And those were ones I expected to enjoy, since I had enjoyed them several times before. And but I found them oppressive because they were about as all Icelandic sagas are, they were about the sort of mushrooming of violence once there's some little incident has set it off and it cannot be contained until it sort of encompasses the whole district. And in some cases it encompasses the whole island. So I found those a little depressing, and then I went on to The Decameron by Giovanni Boccaccio, which I hadn't read before, and I probably heard that it was about sex, and so I probably picked it up for that reason. But it, lo and behold, I open it up, and it's not about sex at all to begin with. It's about the Black Death during about 1350 in Florence. And the whole first chapter, the whole introductory chapter, which is perhaps 40 pages long, is a very graphic description of the effects of the Black Death on the city of Florence. And that was right in the middle of the anthrax scare when we were pondering, especially we were pondering the plague itself because they were talking about biological weapons. And yet, very quickly, Boccaccio's seven young women and three young men move out into the country and they start telling stories. And the stories build a kind of beautiful picture of, and variegated, you know, it's not all happy by any means. A lot of them are tricks, a lot of them are about unsavory or violent things that happen. But very quickly, the stories build a kind of very rich picture of Boccaccio's world, and I found it utterly fascinating.
The entire 3 years seems to be, not to use too much of a cliche, but an affirmation, a narrative arc of great affirmation of hope for you. And you do make the point that reading is an incredibly intimate and personal experience, but it also is a universal experience. And that every nation...
Well, we're lucky that it's universal because we're lucky that we're literate and we're lucky that we live in an age of the cheap paperback book, you know, that for $14 we can go out and buy an attractive and appealing edition of, let's say, one of my favorites, which is The Expedition of Humphrey Clinker, which is a little bit obscure but really worth reading.
Why was that one of your favorites?
Well, it was partly formally because The Expedition of Humphrey Clinker is about a family with a curmudgeonly father that goes on a circuit of spas in England so that in about the mid-18th century so that he can have a cure. And each of the members of the family, the father, his sister, the nephew, the niece, and the servant, write letters home about their experiences, and all their voices are different. And sometimes more than one person writes about the same episode. And it is, in the 18th century tradition, it is bawdy, but, which is not certainly a criticism on my part, but Smollett was a trained physician from the University of Edinburgh. And he was a wonderful observer, and he was interested both in England and in Scotland. So there's a great deal of a travelogue in there. And yet there's also the story of the family kind of coming together, coming into a greater sense of kinship with one another. And of course, Uncle Matthew does find his long-lost son, who is Humphrey. So there's a lot in there that I found, you know, underneath the curmudgeonly surface, which I believe Uncle Matthew shares with Smollett himself, is a kind of generosity that is sort of unmistakable. I thought it was a wonderful book.
For those of you who haven't had a chance to look inside the book, let me give you a brief sort of skeletal of what Jane does, where she sort of tells us in the beginning how she came about to write this book, or no, to read these novels. And then she breaks it down into really 13 ways of looking at a novel. No direct reference, by the way, to Wallace Stevens' 13 ways of looking at a blackboard.
No.
So am I just being showy off?
No, I was thinking of the poem. But I was just hitchhiking on the poem. I wasn't actually engaging with it in a substantive way.
She talks about the novel as a history, or the novel as a moral instrument. And she sort of walks us through this spectacular architecture grab bag of what a novel is. And then she gets very specific about who is a novelist? And that's the part, that's the bits that I underlined the most, because I,
you know,
I found a lot of me in there. So that was, you know, that was good for me. And then she sort of brings it back around to maybe you're a novelist, and if you are, this is what you should do. And then at the end, she gives little thumbnail sketches of all 101. Actually, it's
yes, I did add one at the end,
which you can tell why.
Well, my daughter and I went to Mexico last Christmas, and she brought along some books. And I can't remember what book I brought along, but I got bored with it, and I started rummaging around among her books. And I found a book in pastel covers called Look at Me by a novelist named Jennifer Egan, whom I'd never heard of. And I was really in the mood for some chick lit, so I figured because the covers were pastel that it must be chick lit. But it wasn't chick lit at all. It was really a quite ambitious and bold contemplation of many longstanding concerns of the novel, appearance versus reality. One of the opening scene of the novel, the young woman who's a model in New York gets in a car accident, and her face is wrecked. And after several plastic surgeries, she goes back to New York, and she's unrecognizable. So that's the premises of the novel. And it also took place in one of my least favorite towns in America, Rockford, Illinois. And it was a wonderful portrait of Rockford, Illinois, actually. Insightful, let me put it that way. But she picks up so many threads about sort of media culture, internet culture, the Midwest, you know, what it is to be a woman, what it is to be a girl, because one of the characters in the novel is a young high school girl who's not as good looking as her brother, which I thought was an interesting sort of wrinkle. And so I just said, well, I got to stick this one in there too, you know, partly because it looks forward rather than backward.
Don't you
think
the sense that if she were a real estate agent, she would just sell you land just because she loves the idea of, you know, land ownership, which I know you don't particularly, but were there any that you just said, oh, the hell with this? You know,
there were. I said, oh, the hell with the Grapes of Wrath, which I had enjoyed the Grapes of Wrath a great deal when I was in my early 20s. I thought it was a wonderful book. I just read it voraciously. And this time I could not get into it. There was something about the prose style that just bothered me. And there were other books.
What had you read directly before it? What led
Grapes of Wrath?
Yeah, what was on the...
I wish I could say I know, but
so
I
don't. So you don't think it was just following on something that was just like
no.
on Smollett, for example? Did you read them chronologically?
No. I tried to read them as chronologically as possible, but my organizational skills didn't hold up.
I'm kind of dying to know just the how you did you take a shopping cart into Borders and just load up all at once, or this was
no
this
the book's just sort of accrued, and I from time to time I would line them up, and I'd look at the line and I'd think, boy, that's really pretty, and I'd start going down the line one at a time. But then one didn't hold up was Evelina. I really couldn't get into Evelina.
Who was the author?
Fanny Burney.
18th century.
Yeah, early 19th century.
Okay.
And but you know, so I remember closing Evelina after about page 25 and picking up Roxana by Daniel Defoe. And just being stunned by how great that one was. That's one I really recommend, is Roxana, which was his last novel. He wrote lots of books. Defoe turned out to be the great discovery of my 100 novels, because I had read a couple of Defoe books. I'd read Robinson Crusoe, I'd read Moll Flanders, but I hadn't known much about Defoe, and so I started reading about him, and he really was a very busy, working, hard-working, energetic, and inventive man who wrote about the rights of women. He wrote about ghosts. He wrote about numerous things.
And politics.
He wrote about politics. Once he was in the stocks, and he was put in the stocks, I believe, by the parliament or the king, and people came and threw flowers at him. He went bankrupt 13 times. He died trying to hide from his creditors the last time. Nobody knows exactly where he died. Before he started writing novels, he worked... When famous criminals were hanged at Tyburn, he would write supposed fictional biographies of them and to be sold as pamphlets on the street. So it was one step from that to writing fictional biographies of people like Ma Flanders.
You can see how this book gives you these little pieces, these morsels of, the Germans have a word for the piece of fat that floats on the top of a soup. You know, I don't know what that word is.
I wish we knew. But
Jane is good at producing those little morsels of fat that float on top of the soup, that learning about the novelists themselves. And there are just so many delicious morsels in this. But you do state, and this is one quote, that we can't really understand any one novel without comparing it to others.
That's what I think. I think that the novel is a compromise. It's as a form, you might call it a compromise form. Each of the great novels that we think of grew out of a different precursor. For example, Don Quixote clearly grew out of a kind of travel tale.
You have this lovely bit. If you would you read to us?
Oh, sure.
Where you start in the art of the novel. The lovely bit of this, there's just a rhythm of to who influenced whom.
Let's see.
Maybe artistically novelists.
Okay. Artistically, novelists were do-it-yourselfers, and what they knew about the novel, they gleaned from their favorite authors. We know from their own testimony that Forster read James, James read Dickens, Dickens read Smollett, Smollett read Cervantes, Cervantes read Marguerite of Navarre, Marguerite read Boccaccio, and, of course, Forster read Cervantes, Dickens read Scott, Scott read Boccaccio, Scott read Cervantes, Fielding read Cervantes, Dickens read Cervantes, Wolfe read Austen, Dickens, and James, Stendhal read Marguerite, Balzac read Stendhal, James read Balzac, Turgenev read Stendhal, Stendhal read Madame de Lafayette, Madame de Lafayette read Marguerite de Navarre, Dostoevsky read Turgenev, Tolstoy read Turgenev, Gogol read Turgenev, Turgenev read Lermontov, Lermontov read Scott, Tanizaki read Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and Lady Murasaki, and so forth.
You see that every writer is and must be a reader first. And Jane was telling me this wonderful, at one point you made a chart.
Yeah, I did make a chart and I would put the writer in at his date, and then I'd put an arrow to the writers that I knew from his or her own testimony that he or she had read. And we aren't even talking about 3 degrees of separation here. Generally, we're talking about at the most 2 degrees of separation. The connections between all the writers were very tight and in some ways quite telling. And so what I did was I constructed a clock with 12 different stations on it. As I remember, the romance was at 12, the epic was at 11, the travel narrative was at 1, the history was at 2, the biography was at 3. At the bottom were kind of the more personal or briefer forms, like I think the confession was at 7, the joke was at 5, the tale was at 5, the gossip was at 6.
Yeah.
You know, the opposite to the epic is gossip. And then I took novels that I liked and that I knew fairly well, and I would plot which of the 12 stations they seemed close to or seemed to incorporate, so that a novel like Anna Karenina incorporated maybe 7 stations. A novel like, I can't remember them all, but Pamela incorporated 2 or 3. But you could tell, A, that they weren't comparable to one another because they weren't trying to do the same things. And secondly, you could tell in some cases why they were great. For example, I picked as sort of the paradigmatic great novel, Middlemarch. And I picked it because it's abundant. I think all novels, all great novels are great because they're abundant in some way. They have some quality of abundance that the reader finds almost more than he or she can comprehend. And the quality of abundance that I find in Middlemarch is that abundant wisdom, abundant reason, abundant balance, mental balance. And so you could see that one of the things that an author like George Eliot, whose novel encompasses 7 or 8 of the stations, one of her paths to greatness is that she is attempting to be very capacious. And that's ambition on her part. And the things that she has to do in order to deliver on, let's say, the biography aspect and the history aspect and the gossip aspect are stimulating to her. And so they stimulate her to greater heights of invention. So that was quite... I love doing that. I would plot all the novels around there except that the editor told me that this was not necessary.
This was one of that particular chapter is called The Circle of the Novel. And I live inside that circle. I've written novels. But this was an eye-opener for me. It was for me, too.
I mean, I remember I was on a book tour. I don't remember which book it was. And I was in some dim, dark hotel room with the shades closed. And I had been reading Defoe, and thinking about how Defoe was related to some types of novels, and Genji was related to other types of novels, and Cervantes was related to other. And I have a point to make about Cervantes. And I thought, you know, we can't account for who these novels are unless we account for where they came from. And that's how I came up with that chapter. And I barely wanted to go and do my business for my book tour because I wanted to work that out. And the thing I did come up with, I don't know how recently you all have read The Trial or Don Quixote, but it showed me a connection. The circle showed me a connection between The Trial and Don Quixote. In the second volume of Don Quixote, essentially, he is enlisted by a noble couple that he meets into a trick that's very similar to what happens to Joseph K. in The Trial. He's made fun of. He's given a completely incomprehensible task for some unknown reason. And he's in the position of Joseph K. But in my analysis, in The Trial, one of Kafka's geniuses is that he strips all those other forms away, and all The Trial is, and I mean all in quotation marks, is a tale. And by stripping away all those other extraneous things, he makes you infuse the meaning into the tale, rather than giving you clues about the meaning. But at the end of The Trial, when Joseph is killed by the side of the road, it's meaningless. What we make of it is that it's meaningless. We don't know what happened, we don't know why it happened, and we don't know what the meaning of his death is. Don Quixote goes through a similar process with the Duke and the Duchess, and so does Sancho Panza. But because Cervantes has used 10 of the stations on the circle of the novel, Don Quixote lives a meaningful life and dies a meaningful death. He's been awakened from his illusion, but no one around him, but he's surrounded by friends and the various... And he himself has gained something from the various forms that Cervantes has used to create his narrative. Does that make sense?
It does. So of the two, the more emotionally fulfilling.
Well, it's almost, it's
eater.
Not so much, I don't know that one is more profound than the other. It's as if Don Quixote's life is meaningful to himself because he's been allowed by his author to fall back on these various forms that contribute to the novel and that give the novel meaning. And so in the course of the novel, they give Don Quixote's life meaning. Whereas Kafka has stripped away all those forms and just given you a tale. And when the tale is over, there's no hint of what it meant.
Which is one of the symptoms of modernity.
Yes, but well,
one of the more stunning things that I found in this, when you were talking about the novel and history, is your take on the novel's influence. I mean, I was shocked to read that you think that what the novel really had a great impact in terms of a social contract, the institution that it had its greatest impact upon, was marriage.
Well, I think, yes, I do think that's true. One of the early books I read was The Heptameron by Marguerite of Navarre. And this book has pretty much fallen by the wayside, but it was Marguerite's attempt to redo the Decameron. But instead of telling fictional tales the way Boccaccio does, she asks her, and she was a real king's queen. I mean, she was the queen of Navarre. She was the sister of Francois I, king of France. And she proposes that they tell the tales on the subject of whether a woman can be truly virtuous and know true love. And that they meant to tell 100 tales, but only 72 of them are extant. And they cannot come up with a story. Even the ones that say it is possible cannot come up with a story that illustrates this. It's like they're in an imaginative bind, that their culture has put them into an imaginative bind like of this sort. And this question about whether a woman in some sense is an agent or a possession of her family is then proceeds to be the perennial question of European literature up till about the early 20th century. And the way it's channeled forward is through The Princess of Cleves, a novel by Madame de Lafayette. And Madame de Lafayette lived 120 years after Marguerite of Navarre, but she's quite well aware of her. And in the court of Francois I, she sets her tale of a woman who does find both true love and virtue. And French writers were preoccupied with this question, with the question of women, what do women do, what are they for, what do we do with them, how do we treat them, how do they think of themselves, well through Proust, well into the 20th century. And because the French were preoccupied with it, other novelists influenced by them, of course, plus other novelists on their own were preoccupied with this. So the effect of asking this question was to ask, well, what's the meaning of marriage? And each culture would come up with a different answer. And each answer would be kind of contingent because it wouldn't work. Whatever the answer was, it didn't work. And the other effect of the novel that I thought was so interesting was that it's not every man a king, it's everyone a protagonist. So let's say the novel Pamela comes out, and the novel Pamela is about Pamela's attempts not to be raped by her employer. And it's quite violent in some ways, and also quite sort of Cinderella-ish in some ways. But when a young girl, let's say, would be reading Pamela in the 18th century, she would identify with Pamela. She would identify with the girl who didn't want to be raped. And so this would move into a larger question. Well, okay, she's not going to be raped, but is she going to be married off to someone she doesn't want to be married off to. There's nothing that society can do to prevent a reader from identifying with a protagonist, even if the reader is an average person and a protagonist is an exceptional person. So pretty soon, everybody starts thinking of themselves as protagonists and exceptional persons, and you know, they start working out their moral dilemmas in ways that the society and the church really don't want them to do. You know, they start saying, well, I wonder if I should do the right thing here or if I just should do what I'm told. Well, a protagonist never does what he or she is told. He always does whatever his or her conscience demands. It's in the nature of a plot. And yet, as the novel expands into the society and is taken up by, as more and more people become literate and more people become novelists, then more and more see their own moral dilemmas as worthy of a lot of thought. I always laugh when I think of what Boccaccio would have thought of Isabel Archer. You know, that Isabel Archer would spend so much time pondering her inner life, and we would spend so much time pondering it with her. And yet that's a index of how the ability of the novel to ponder the inner life grew in the course of, what, I guess 350 years, but how the inner life itself was transformed by the constant introspection and inspection of novelists. And so I came to see the novel, the form of the novel, as a kind of stealth bomber, you know, that blew up the way people thought of themselves in the early modern period and turned them into us, you know, self-conscious, self-reflecting, able to reason about our morality, about morality and feelings and, you know, almost sometimes to a degree that our families don't really care to join us in.
She spares absolutely, she's not shy about saying what a subversive act reading, both reading and writing, is and are. And before we move to questions, I want you to read again. I want you to read on 175.
Okay.
This will give you pretty much a synopsis of Jane's own personal philosophy. I saw with some surprise, maybe? Could you start there?
Should I mark this? I saw with some surprise. This is after I read all my novels. I saw with some surprise that my world is fragile, not only because of forces from the East, but also because of forces from within the West. Forces from Texas, forces from Wyoming, forces from the evangelical right, forces from the corporate world, forces from the world of think tanks and political institutes. We seem to live in a world now where all thoughts are focused on the idea of prevailing, of imposing one's beliefs on others, and no thoughts are given to the costs of prevailing or even what it means. Have these people never read Moby Dick? Well, no, they
haven't. And now we're going to open to questions. There is a...
Thank you.
There's a microphone. Well, you've probably all done this before. Yes.
Sorry, question. Do you have one favorite book, favorite novel that's closest to your heart?
Did everybody hear that?
The question is, do you have one favorite novel?
Well, you know, I would have said yes 100 novels ago. But as I read, I discovered that they're so not comparable to one another that I would have to say, well, I love the abundance of, let's say, Justine, because it's so relentlessly and astoundingly cruel. And I love the abundance of Our Mutual Friend because it's so stylistically perfect. And I love the abundance of The Man Who Loved Children because its analysis of a certain kind of dysfunctional family life is so abundant. So no, I don't have a favorite novel anymore. I found that after my 100 novels, I liked all novels better than I had.
Where do you think the novel is going?
Well, that's both a technological question and a sensibility question. I do not think that they have solved, I don't think they have come up with any item of technology that beats the paperback book for cheapness, portability, and concentration of pleasure. And so because that's true, I don't think in some ways the novel is going anywhere. I think it's going to ebb and flow the way it has been. And the sensibility question is, do people retain a pleasure in complexity? Because that's basically, the novel is the most complex sort of narrative, and a person has to have a pleasure in complexity in order to enjoy the novel. And, you know, the only thing I can say to that is, judging by my children, you know, two love novels, two read them. One wouldn't read a novel to save her life. One would read a novel to save his life. And the third one may have to read a novel to save his life. But still, 2 out of 5 isn't bad. And there's always hope for the rest. And so I think that people who say the novel is dying, they don't understand that there are younger people with different tastes who are still reading novels. They just aren't the same novels that so-and-so who writes for Commentary is reading.
I'm very interested in your opinion or take on the big books, Ulysses and In Search of Lost Time.
Well, about Ulysses, I'll only say that when I finished Ulysses, I picked up Hermann Brook's novel, The Sleepwalkers, and I found it to be a relief. which maybe no one else in the history of reading has ever said. Because The Sleepwalkers is not easy reading either. But In Search of Lost Time, I hadn't intended to read. And I started to read it, and I read a little more. And then I really enjoyed it. And I recommend it, and I think it's wonderful to read. But I think you have to do it in a systematic way. And my system was to read 65 pages a day for about 75 days. I took a little time off sort of in the middle. And I read Ars for Ricochet by Sue Grafton. But one of the things that In Search of Lost Time does, if you just read it over a long period of time, is it seems to sort of infuse all of your molecules and atoms with a sort of spurious feeling that you're French. and yet it's a delicious feeling. And as I read it, I became more and more intrigued, not only by Proust's sensibility, which is obviously very detailed and refined and meticulous and sensuous and valuable for all those reasons, but also that he was a de Sade under the skin, you know? I mean, he kidnapped her, he kept her in his house, if he could have, he would have beat her. You know, he had that feeling that de Sade had of, you know, I'm getting a little tired of her, I'm a little jaded by her, I have to do something to her to get my feelings up, even though she wasn't a her, she was a him. So he had this very strange way of being in the absolute tradition of French literature, and yet doing it in his own Proustian way. And I found that fascinating, and I still think about Proust a lot. I find things that I remember, scenes from In Search of Lost Time come back to me almost daily. And it's probably because I read it over such a lengthy period of time.
I have the microphone here. Now that you've done this reading and you've written this book, what are you thinking of doing next? Do you have the confidence to write again?
And also, I already have 450 pages of my next novel written. And what I did was, you know, I said for years, I might have even said it in Los Angeles, that I was going to write a book about sex in Hollywood. But I could never really come up with a way to go about it. And so after I read all these books, I came up with a way to go about it. And it's sheer genius as far as I can tell. I mean, I'm always enthusiastic in the middle of a book. That's probably the one thing I share with Charles Dickens. Charles Dickens always loved whatever he was working on at the time. And so I'm quite enthusiastic about this book. And I said to my Hollywood agent the other day, I said, you know, Lynn, they keep talking about movies and not having sex. And she said, oh, God, that's just the way it really is. So we'll see.
A professor told me to read a series of essays that were really hard to get through, but changed my life, by a crazy Russian named Bakhtin.
Oh, yes.
Have you read him? Who sometimes
I've read some Bakhtin, and then what you should really do is read the Crib Notes, which are by David Lodge.
Oh, well, it's too late. I read the whole thing. And it took me several weeks to get through, and it was astonishing, and he defines the novel. He defines strange things of the novel. Even cartoons could be novels. And he defines the novel as a lot of different voices with different opinions from the whole world, from all different classes, and none of them are quite the opinion of the author, and you have to figure out what it is the author really wants. I've just distilled like 1,000 pages. And he also said that because of what you would call abundance, which is a great way to describe it, that once the novel was invented, everything else suddenly became totally old-fashioned in comparison, because like the epic, everybody in the epic agrees who the bad guy is and the good guy is and what the good religion is. And in the novel, there's so many different points of view that...
I haven't read Bakhtin in a while, but one of the things I remember noticing, because I read Bakhtin when I was... Or else I read the Crib Notes by David Lodge, which are in a book called After Bakhtin, I think. One of the things I remember... I was reading some volume of Dickens at the same time or around the same time, and I noticed that alerted me to how wonderful Dickens is in his ability to shift from, I wouldn't call it voice, but shift from language to language, even within the same sentence or the same paragraph, just by, he can use a phrase that is idiosyncratic to a certain, let's say, segment of the population. And then a sentence later, he uses a different phrase that's idiosyncratic to a different segment of the population. And so Dickens' style becomes this incredibly rich sort of mosaic of the language that's around him. And he was especially good at this. Not everybody is as good at it as he was, but that's part of his characteristic abundance. But I think at one point in this book, I say any reader can construct her list of 10 favorite novels, and that list would keep an army of critics busy for 50 years, you know, analyzing them, saying how they work, saying how they're related to one another. But all she has to do is read them. She can completely intuit and understand and comprehend what's in those 10 novels over and over and over again, because the novel is not written by the intellect. It is a set of sensory feelings and sensations and emotions that are translated into language, put on the page, and then retranslated into images and languages by the reader. The novelist has no control over how you retranslate his or her work. But if it satisfies you, if it's fulfilling and pleasurable to you, then you have had an experience that is really the true experience of the novel and is is its only value. So the reason the critics have so much difficulty kind of trying to come up with a theory of the novel, come up with a way to grasp the abundance of the novel, is because they can't use their intuition. They can't use their emotions. They have to use, you know, reason and ideas. The thing I found difficult about writing this book was also the thing that it was so easy. The ideas just came like that. But they could also be tossed out like that. You know, the book itself didn't have a kind of inherent emotional integrity that a novel that I would be write would have. And so it could come and go. It was trivial. It was just a bunch of ideas. It was lots of fun. It was like fireworks, but it wasn't like that. It wasn't like another, that inner part of my mind that is the intuition that sees how the horses in Horse Heaven that intuits how they see things in the world. Those aren't ideas. Those are forms of empathy that come from somewhere else, that come from instinct or something else. And those have a sense of rightness or wrongness. The ideas could be right or wrong. They're just ideas. You know, I'm glad that they worked out okay in this case. But but I have to say, you know, my best friend is an editor, who was an editor for years at Viking. She doesn't agree with me. You know, she thinks nonfiction books often have a kind of intuitive integrity, and novels are often a bunch of bullshit. So, but that's, once again, she's exercising her freedom. But she's very short, so that's probably part of the reason we disagree.
We have time for one more question.
My question had two parts. Can I get away with that? Okay. After reading all of these books, I'm wondering if you came to any conclusions, observations that were unexpected. You know, there's the various characteristics of a novel,
sure,
and a Forster and so on. Wondering what you saw that you weren't expecting to see. And secondly, how this influenced, without giving away what you chose to do with your current novel in progress, what you do differently as a writer as a result of reading all of these, if anything.
Well, yes, I did. What I respected in a lot of these novelists was their patience and their willingness to linger over something, over the character or the scene or the event or whatever. And I had always felt, you know, the plot's winged chariot hurrying near, you know, a little poke in the back, get on with it. And so I guess that with this new novel, I wanted to try to be a little more patient and to linger a little bit and to let the characters have their say without making them, you know, get on to the next plot point. So we'll see how that works out. It's not every reader has the patience for that, and I understand that. I found out, and the first part of your question was, were there things, unexpected things that I came up with? There were so many of them, I can't even begin to tell you. They're here, you know, and they're more, and I could have gone on longer in some ways about the things that came out that astounded me. But I think the chapter, The Circle of the Novel, it has the most concentrated group of things that I found unexpectedly.
The joys of this book will be returning to you for years and years and years. It's something that you will go back to, read, reread, refer to. I think it's a necessary reference point. A rough guide to an unlonely planet.
Well, that's for sure. I think that's the great thing about the novel. The novel, I've said that six times, but the novel is such a sociable It's such a sociable object. You know, it's always reaching out to other novels and to other people and to characters, and it's it can't be lonely if there's a row of novels in your room.
And this is also the most personal work. I felt Jane is really bare Jane. She's just, you know, Jane à la nu. And it's a joy. I encourage you to buy it and to keep it. We've been told that Jane. Where is Jane? Is she here signing?
No, outside.
Outside somewhere. You will get direction. Before we go,
I have
managed to bring a birthday cake.
Oh, so cute!
Since you did go to all the effort of telling us that September produces the best writers.
Well, not the best, but a good group.
September produces some writers. You know, barbed scorpions.
Not all novelists. Marina Tsvetaeva was born on my birthday too.
They won't let me light the candles here in the library. I guess you can understand why. So, happy birthday to you. Don't leave me alone. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Jane Smiley. Happy birthday to you.
That's really
Thank
sweet.
You.